Welcome to the FarmBeats podcast.
FarmBeats is proudly produced by the Nebraska Digital Agricultural Team and hosted by students at the University of Nebraska.
The FarmBeats podcast comes to you each week to discuss the trends, the realities, and the value of digital agriculture.
Through interviews with experts, producers, and innovators from across the agricultural industry, we hope that you step away from each episode with new practical knowledge of digital agriculture technology. Hello, FarmBeats followers, and welcome to another episode of the FarmBeats podcast. I'm Katie Bathke.
And I'm Deepak Imre, and we are glad to have you with us as we continue our discussion on space for ag with Dr. Anna-Lisa Paul from University of Florida, sharing her research in the field of plant molecular biology. Thank you, Dr. Paul, for joining us today. Could you introduce yourself by sharing your background up until where you are now?
That's a long story, but my name's Anna-Lisa Paul. I am a research professor at the University of Florida, and I'm also the director of the Interdisciplinary Center for Biotechnology Research here at UF. And so that's a different center. So I wear two hats at the university. What got me here is an interest in how plants work. And so part of the interest for understanding how plants respond to harsh and novel environments is one of the things that got me interested in spaceflight research, because spaceflight's a truly novel environment outside the evolutionary experience of any terrestrial organism. So understanding how plants respond to that kind of environment is both intrinsically interesting from a very fundamental science point of view, the things you can learn when you take gravity out of the equation, but it's also really fascinating to think about what is it going to take for us to take ourselves off the planet? And one of the things that we'll need is plants to help us with the journey.
That's awesome. My first degree is in plant biology, so I'm very excited to hear about this because I love all things plants. So with that, it was a great introduction on kind of how you got into your research and kind of how space fits into that equation. So as this season is the topic of kind of what we call space for ag and like how agriculture fits in that space, can you give us a brief overview of what that means to you?
Sure. So when people say space ag, you know, who knows what it is people are really envisioning? You know, probably it's giant rotating greenhouses orbiting the planet, or giant greenhouses on the surface of the moon or Mars. But for now, things, of course, are very small. But we have to learn first how plants respond to that environment. You know, what are the things that they're pulling out of their molecular toolbox to adapt to something they have no clue on how to adapt to until they try. And so the important part of that is that if we do go ourselves past the Earth's orbit, whether it be in long-term exploration between here and Mars or in extended bases on the surface of the moon, plants are the only way that we're going to be able to do that for an extended period of time. You think about it from the perspective of plants are what enable us to explore past the limits of a picnic basket. And so for me, space agriculture means how do we first learn about how plants respond to the environment? And then second, how do we help them adapt to growing in situations that will help us support in those environments and grow ourselves in that kind of habitat? Because without plants, we're not going to be able to do it.
Yeah, that's just a great overview. Thank you for sharing that. It's very exciting to know, like, getting plants to space all starts with the work here in Earth. Can you please share, like, how did you become involved in this aspect of, like, agricultural research for space?
Well, I guess it mostly comes from getting, you write grants. And so my colleague Rob Furl and I are long-term plant molecular biologists, and again, you know, interested in plants in strange and unusual environments, whether that be terrestrial environments or novel environments like space. And we wrote grants to NASA to say, you know, we really want to be able to explore this type of aspect of plant biology, plant molecular biology. And we are the best folks that are poised to be able to ask these particular questions. And here's a proposal of why we think you should give us money to do this. And so NASA reviews those proposals. It sends out for review from the science community. And they say, yeah, you know, those guys, they really do have a pretty good idea. And yes, we'll allow them to send plants. At first, it was on the space shuttle back in 1999. And then subsequently, we have had 11 more spaceflight experiments that have gone to the space station. And as a long, you know, more than a couple of decades career, we have slowly but surely unraveled some of the mechanisms by which plants physiologically adapt to spaceflight. And as a consequence, we are learning more and more about what it will take to be somewhat reliant on plants in the agricultural sense of things, because if you don't know how they work, you're not going to be able to grow them and rely on them.
That's such a unique point and so interesting. I love that you come at this question with like a very plant focused, molecular focused background. I think that's so interesting and also so cool. You've been doing this since 1999. Like, that's awesome. Yes. So we're going to break it down into the research a little bit now. And can you speak with us about the Artemis project, including the specifics on using lunar soil?
Absolutely. So, as you know, it's been a long time since humans have been to the moon. And back in the day, when the first Apollo astronauts were visiting the moon and learning how to move around as humans on that kind of surface, they, of course, collected a lot of material. They collected rocks, they collected moon dirt, which is not really dirt, you call it, it's regolith, nothing organic in it. And they brought that back for study. It's been studied for decades, 50 plus years, by geologists and physiochemists and physicists and all manner of folks, but not by biologists. And part of the reason for that is that, you know, once you put a plant in a teaspoon of regolith, it's ruined forever if you're a physicist or a geochemist, because plants will change what that material is inherently. And so it's a destructive process, just like if you were to, you know, use a laser on it to see the atoms that it's composed of. So it took a while before we, Rob Ferrell and I, convinced NASA that, yep, you really should give us a little bit of regolith, because with the Artemis initiative, the concept is humans will be going back to the moon. Humans will be going back to the moon to work and study for extended periods of time. And getting back to what I said earlier is that if we want to have that kind of extended presence on the moon, you really do need to have plants in the equation to help us supplement your diet, recycle air and water. And also, it's becoming increasingly important that plants, and having a terrestrial morsel of home in the form of plants and a plant habitat, does wonders for isolation for humans. And so plants are an important component, not only for air recycling and food, but also for the psychological welfare of humans as well. So the Artemis program is a vast and extensive initiative by NASA that is to go back to the moon and spend some time there. There has yet been a large agricultural component of that, but recently we received, Rob Ferrell and I received, a 12 grams of Apollo regolith and 4 grams each from Apollo 11, Apollo 12, and Apollo 17. We got together also with another one of our colleagues here at the University of Florida, Steve Alardo, who is a geologist at UF as well. And we designed an experiment to ask the question of, can plants grow in lunar regolith as the sole source of substrate to grow? And also, what are the kind of molecular tools plants use to adapt to that kind of new and crazy environment?
Thanks for sharing that. I think that's a great achievement, I would say. And I think that was a very exciting moment, like when you had that regolith from the moon with you. Can you share us, like, what were your initial thoughts from you and your group once you received that soil, and about growing plants in that new media?
Getting to hold the moon in your hand is an extraordinary experience beyond words. So when Rob and I first receive the material, we're looking at it, and we have the little vials, we're taking them out and examining them. And first of all, being absolutely stunned with the fact that here is a portion of our childhood. I mean, he and I both remember watching the first moonwalks, you know, back in 1969. We remember seeing that and being absolutely amazed and stunned that humans could get that far. And I remember as a kid watching that and feeling, you know, proud to be human, that gosh, we could really do that. I mean, how amazing is that? So fast forward all those decades, and here we are standing in our laboratory with a bit of the moon in the palm of our hands, thinking, wow, we now have the amazing privilege to be a little bit a part of that history, both from the past and now going forward with exploration. So what we did is we took that regolith and we set it up in the experiment format that we had been practicing for years and years with simulants to make sure that we knew what we were doing when we finally actually got the real deal. And we set it up as a standard experiment like you would for anything else, where we have replicates. We had 4 replicates for each of the sites. We grew them in little teeny tiny dishes that could hold 900 milligrams of regolith in each little well in the dish. And then we compared that to a simulant called JSC1A. And so that was our control. So if you look at the control versus the lunar regolith, the very first aspect of it that we had no idea was, would the seeds even germinate? And so we did our planting, and there's plenty of stuff on the web where you could look at how that worked and videos and stuff. But the bottom line is that a couple of days after we planted them, we go back out to the growth room, and that's just because you can't stay away. You just want to see what they look like. And to walk into the room and take a look at the fact that every seed germinated in our little dishes, the controls, the regolith, they all germinated. And to realize that with our eyes, our 4 eyes that were watching those plants at that minute, we were the first people ever to see a terrestrial organism growing in an extraterrestrial material. And it was profoundly moving to see that. Irrespective of the science and the implications and everything else, just to see that was extraordinary experience. So fast forward a little bit. Yep, they all germinated, but they didn't all grow really well. And so once they got to be about a little less than 3 weeks old, we were taking pictures and stuff all the way through, but we definitely noticed that some of the plants did better than others. For instance, the Apollo 12, plants growing in the Apollo 12 regolith, they looked, you know, they're small, but they look like healthy-ish normal plants, just small. Plants growing in the Apollo 11 regolith, however, were kind of small and squinchy. You know, they didn't do very well at all. They had a harder time getting established in the regolith, and they didn't grow as robustly. So when we looked at now the patterns of gene expression, we harvested those plants, ground them up, extracted the RNA from them, and asked what genes, what molecular tools are the plants using to adjust to growing in regolith? And we found that that all plants, even if they looked healthy, turned on genes that are associated with a number of different stress responses that are characterized in terrestrial systems, like, for instance, salt stress, metal stress, reactive oxygen species stress. All of those things are genes that are typically used to help a plant adjust to a hostile environment. You put a plant with got flooded with seawater, they're going to turn a whole bunch of salt stress genes on. You have other types of drought stress or high UV stress, all these different kinds of things. They'll turn on reactive oxygen species genes to try to adjust. Well, the plants growing in our growth rooms, of course, had none of those things going on, but they were not knowing what to use to respond to an environment that to say, you know, I know that trying to grow in this stuff is hard. And it sort of feels like salt stress. It sort of feels like, you know, this kind of stress. And so plants start to pull these tools out of their molecular toolbox to say, I'm going to try throwing this gene at it and see if that helps me grow better, et cetera. I mean, anthropomorphizing that quite crazy. But that's the idea, is that the reason why plants turn on all these genes to deal with stress is because they're trying to find something that will make them better adjusted to that environment. And what we found is that plants growing in lunar regolith turn on a whole suite of genes that are typically associated with reactive oxygen species, salt stress, and metal stress. And they don't like it. So the next step for that is to understand why the regoliths are different. And it turns out, like I said, the Apollo 11 regolith is a little harsher than, say, Apollo 12. And one of the things that is different between those two sites is that Apollo 11 is a lot older, close to a billion with a B years older, something like, I don't know, 900 million years older on the surface than the Apollo 12 sites. And so after the regolith has had this exposure to the solar wind and different types of weathering and stuff, that material is sharper, harsher, more difficult to grow in, more inimical than it is the Apollo 12 regolith. And so one of the things that also speaks to is not only the tools that plants use to try to adjust to it, but also the fact that, you know, when we do use regolith as an in situ resource on the surface of the moon for habitats, we might want to first think about the site that we're going to, and also understand that it's going to take some mitigation. You can't just scoop up a bucket of regolith and toss a plant in it and hope that you're going to get potatoes, you know, 6 months later. So you're going to have to be able to, what we would consider, condition the regolith before it's going to be useful to plants.
That is such an extraordinary way to put your research. I really like you broke down the science. Even if it starts in like a standard experiment, you showed us how excited you were to be the first eyes to do something like this. This is awesome. So thank you for explaining your research to such detail. It's so amazing to see the adventurous and the exciting and the so many questions that your research is bringing, especially in an environment where plants are not adapted to. And I think you did this amazing job at explaining what plants have to do to create those adaptations. And your research is really just a testament to like to how they will do it. So I think that's really awesome. So what are the next steps or follow-up studies that you plan to undertake based on the outcomes of the research that you've been doing?
So I think that's an easy one as far as the next steps. And I bet that, you know, you guys sitting there in Nebraska are already thinking to yourself, you know, if it were me, I'd do that soil conditioning that you were talking about, and I'd see if those plants were going to do any better. And that's what we are doing right now. And so we took those original little bits of regolith. And by the way, it all has to go back to NASA. We're not allowed to keep it, not a single grain. So we're all being very careful about managing it and stuff, even though it is all, you know, messed up and biologicalized now. All has to go back. But so now we're into, we conditioned that regolith for three times and in growing a second set and generation of plants. And again, in the same exact same little wells of material. But by the third time, what we had also done is it had been thoroughly sort of washed and mixed up in little tiny tubes and then centrifuge down and put it back into these wells. It always can now, you might think of it as contaminated with bits of plant roots that were from the original harvest, from the bacteria and the fungus and things that just naturally grow in biological systems. And so the rhizosphere of the roots that were of plants growing in it. And so by the time we've used it the third time, we saw an interesting thing. And now there's very little difference between Apollo 11 and Apollo 12 and Apollo 17 regolith, for instance. They all grew pretty much very similarly to each other and also grew very similar to the controls. And so we can see that they look now very much better than they used to. And so then, of course, we do what we do because we're molecular geneticists is we cut them up and we ground them up and looked at their RNA. And what we found now is that in contrast to the hundreds and hundreds of genes that are differentially expressed in response to growing in regolith, now we have just a handful. And furthermore, the handful of genes that are expressed compared to the controls are different than the first set. And so now we have if you look side by side, you know, just the spreadsheets of the genes that were first induced by the regolith compared to the genes that are now being induced by the regolith, they're different and they're not as intense. And so in some of the genes that you did see still being expressed, instead of being expressed tenfold, they're expressed maybe twofold or something along those lines. And so we've definitely seen that we can mitigate, we can, the stress response, we can condition the regolith into something that a plant can actually grow in and not be too freaked out about.
That sounds really exciting. Sounds like we'll soon have the capacity or the ability like to recondition the soil to whatever amount it takes and then grow plants in space. So as of now, with these advancements and research that are being conducted here on Earth to advance the space in egg, so how do you envision the growing plants in space would look like? Like to, as you also stated in the beginning of our conversation, that either it's going to be a revolving greenhouse or plants on like the surface. So how do you envision the growing the plants in space would look like?
So when you say space, now you mean orbital space, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So even though we all love the science fiction notion of these giant orbital habitats and stuff, the circular wheel of the space station, yeah, that's just not going to happen. I think, well, it's highly unlikely that that will happen in the near future decades, because it's just way too expensive to have that kind of a structure. So what's more likely is that plant habitats on the space station will continue to get larger, or in new space stations, but they are still going to be a microgravity environment. You're not going to have revolving space stations. And so the biggest challenge for growing plants truly in space, and that's whether it be in a low Earth orbit, like the current space station, or in a transit vehicle from here to Mars, is dealing with microgravity. It's, on some hand, you think, well, how hard can that be? We found from a lot of the research that Rob and I have done over the years, and many others, that plants grow in microgravity just fine if you engineer their habitats to accommodate the fact you don't have convection, right? So warm air doesn't rise, cold air doesn't sink, water doesn't sink. You have fluid physics is probably one of the biggest problems that plants have in space. It's not the biology, it's the physics that's associated with managing gases and managing liquids. And so the better an engineer you are to create a plant habitat that manages fluids, that manages the gas exchange, the better plants that you're going to have. When plants don't have gravity, they use other cues to navigate. We did a pretty early on in 2009, we did some experiments where we asked some of the questions about how do plants navigate without microgravity or without gravity. And essentially they use light. And so if you have think about it as a gradient. And so if you have a light gradient where it's higher up here and lower down here, the plants use that gradient as a very easy cue of roots growing away from the light. Seems really obvious when you think about it. I mean, we all know that how plants grow towards the light here. But what we think about less is that the roots like to grow away from light. But on the space station, when they also don't have a gravity cue, they have to engineer themselves to create the sensors to be more effective to grow away from the light. And so what we found is that the plant roots, especially even the very root tips, induce a number of genes that are associated with light signaling that normally are not expressed in roots. And so in space, roots make these genes that can detect light, whereas on the ground, they don't need it because, you know, they got gravity. So it's a really interesting concept that, again, well, you know, pulling tools out of your molecular toolbox of, yep, I need to use a different cue than gravity. Well, let's try light, because I'm pretty used to dealing with light in terrestrial environments. And so that works very well. So as long as the plants get watered in an effective manner, they have their gases mixed so they don't asphyxiate with just having oxygen or CO2 just right around them, they do pretty okay in space flight. And so I have every confidence that the habitats that are in an orbital environment or a transit environment from here to Mars, it's all just about engineering and they'll be just fine.
That is so cool. So interesting on the concept of pulling gravity out of the equation and what do they need to do at that point. But what are your thoughts on how the agriculture and space can benefit from the current state-of-the-art technologies, such as different sensors, just kind of different applications like that?
Yeah. So my goodness, it's really interesting to watch how they're so connected with terrestrial advances, space advances, many of the things, for instance, if you think about protected ag in greenhouses and stuff, a lot of the robotic greenhouses that are being used or vertical farms and things like that, that are being used very effectively terrestrially, a lot of that stemmed from early NASA associated work of how do we grow things with low impact of light, low impact of energy in containerized environments. And so that kind of stuff just feeds back and forth to each other. One of the things that we had the privilege to do is Rob Furl and I worked down in Antarctica for a while. And we worked as part of a Neumeier 3 research station that's a German research station down there. And they had developed, the German Space Agency developed a greenhouse that they call the FEG, the Future Exploration Greenhouse, that's an all aeroponic computer controlled greenhouse that is could be completely autonomous, that you might envision on the surface of the moon or Mars. And one of the things that we were down there doing is working on imaging of how do you, if it's you have an autonomous greenhouse, how do you use imaging to help evaluate the health of the plants? And I don't just mean, oh man, tray 27 is wilted, go water it. It's more like, well, can we use different types of spectral imaging to ask what are the pigments that are changing within the plants that we can't even see with our naked eye, so that we can get a heads up that something's amiss in 2027, way before they're wilted or way before they've got salt stress or anything else. And in fact, this is one of the things that happened while we were down there. And so this kind of imaging tools now with hyperspectral imaging, for instance, in agricultural use with NDVI drones that are going through croplands, it's all interconnected. And so as we, you know, learn how to do more of that here in terrestrial ag, that gets modified to use in extraterrestrial ag. And as we learn more things in extraterrestrial, that feeds right back into the stuff that we're doing in our own fields and farms here.
I love that you brought up the connection point. I think that is so important, especially for our viewers. So I really like that you talk about how we make these connecting points and how what we learn over here in production ag can feed what we learn over here in extraterrestrial environment and vice versa.
Yeah, I think that's a great overview. Thank you for sharing that. So moving forward, like as we are talking about optimistic goals and of having plants grown in space on moon. So what do we think, like what would be the biggest challenges moving forward with agriculture in space?
Well, I think that the biggest challenge for agriculture in space is the biggest challenge for anything in space or here, and that's resources, right? And so when you think about what it takes to grow, just think about a backyard greenhouse, even just a teeny tiny little backyard greenhouse. Think about the resources it takes to keep that up and running and managed and et cetera, et cetera. It's a non-trivial amount of time and energy that goes into that. And the same is going to be true for space. If we want to have a greenhouse, for instance, on the surface of the moon as part of a plant, part of a human habitat, having a plant habitat there, first of all, you're going to have the energy to either gather the light from the surface in light pipes or some other kind of technology, or you're going to have the electricity to do LED lighting that's going to be supporting those plants. You're going to have to engineer the water systems to keep things nourished and hydrated. You're going to have to be able to have a substrate. And what you can't do is you can't ship dirt from Earth because it's too expensive. The equation that you always think about when you are taking anything off the surface of the Earth, it's called equivalent systems mass, ESM. And every ounce, every gram that you take off the surface of the Earth comes at a cost, comes at a big cost. Just like thinking about the cost it takes in gasoline to truck a resource from one point to another in Nebraska, you know, multiply that by, you know, tens of thousands, and you've got what it costs to take, or millions, from here to elsewhere off the surface of the Earth. So the more we can use in-situ resources, and this is another cool NASA acronym, is ISRU, in-situ resource utilization, the better we are off. So if we can use, quote, dirt from the moon as a growth substrate, if we can use dirt from the moon to create glasses, to create building blocks, to create the kind of substructures and stuff that we need in our habitats, it saves so much in terms of energy and resources. And so that's one of the true innovations that NASA and commercial space are looking into, is how do we use those in-situ resources on the surface of the moon? For us, that's a good part of, you know, why we're checking out how you can use regolith as a substrate. Not only is it something that plants can grow in, it's also something that plants can mine. And the irons, the other chemicals and stuff that are in lunar regolith, a human cannot just eat a spoonful of regolith and get any nutritive value out of it at all, but a plant can. And so plants can now mine some of those elements out of a regolith and turn them into stuff that humans can use. Iron's a great example. You know, I mean, even here on Earth, you can't go out and chew on a bucket of rust and get your nutritive iron out of that. You have to let a plant do that for you. And it's the same as true whether you're here or you're on the surface of the moon or Mars.
That's awesome. I love that. On the flip side of that, what are you most looking forward to in the future of research with agriculture and space?
Oh, boy. Looking forward to. I guess I'm looking forward to seeing the next steps. You know, I'm far enough along in my career that I may not ever see my plants on the surface of the moon or Mars. Maybe, but probably not. But I do love being part of the story. You know, part of the foundational work that is eventually going to be useful for the folks who are growing plants on the moon or Mars and habitats. And so for me, that's profoundly satisfying and really exciting is, you know, I want to see what's next.
That's awesome.
I think with that, like, we talked most of the things that we were about to talk for this concerning your work and your thoughts about space in ag. So if our listeners wanted to learn more about the work that you are doing, so where can they find that information?
So probably the easiest place to find information about our work is, so Rob Furl and I have a website. It's, if you just were to Google ufspaceplants.org, you'd find us. You can even, you know, if you search my name in quotes, you'll probably find a few things on the web and stuff associated with, although there's other people with my name, but, you know, add space to that and it'll probably be pretty easy to find. A lot of published work. If you go into Google Scholar, again, you can search and find scientific publications about it. But there's also a lot of popular web stuff that you can find. If you're a Neil deGrasse Tyson fan, Rob Furl and I have an interview with Star Talk. And so you could find that on the web too. And you can always, through you, they can email.
All right. And is there anything we didn't talk about today that you might want to add or share with our listeners?
I guess the one thing that I would add is that I hope that I hope that fundamentally everybody truly appreciates the fact that the one thing that all of us humans have in common is that we're all explorers. And whether that be, you know, in your own backyard as a kid, turning over rocks to seeing what's underneath, or winding up being a space biologist or engineer or chemist or something, it's all part of, yeah, just wanting to explore. And the more we remember that that's part of all of us, even if you're, you know, a different culture, different background or anything, standing in the DMV line with a total stranger, you think to yourself, you know, I may have nothing in common with this person that I know on the surface, but deep down inside, we're all explorers.
I love that perspective. I think it shines like so much through your work. And so, it was a traditional fun to have you.
That we have is to ask for a piece of advice. So what advice would you give to anyone interested in the future of like agriculture in space?
Oh, so who knows Magic School Bus? My advice is right up there with Ms. Frizzle. Is get messy, make mistakes. You know, do not be afraid to push the boundaries, you know, get out there and get dirty and dig in the dirt, because you never know what you're going to find. Can't be afraid to explore.
Thank you very much to Dr. Annalisa Paul for taking the time to join this episode of the Farm Beats podcast. It's really exciting to hear about her fascinating works to advance the idea of growing plants in lunar soil and space. One of my favorite parts of this episode was the fact that the mission to space egg all starts with amazing works all here on Earth.
I would have to agree. It was incredible to hear her work story from being one of the first people to see plants grow in moon soil. And also, I loved her perspective on the interconnections between space agriculture and agriculture on Earth. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and we look forward to sharing another digital ag story with you next week on Farm Bits.
Thank you for taking the time to join us today on the Farm Bits podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you listen to podcasts to be informed about the latest content each week.
We welcome your feedback. So if you have any comments or questions for us, please reach out to us over email, on Twitter, or in the review section of your favorite podcast platform. Our contact information can be found in the show notes.
We would like to thank Nebraska Extension for their support of this podcast and their commitment to providing high quality informational material to members of the agricultural community in Nebraska and beyond.
The opinions expressed by the host and guest on this podcast are solely their own and do not reflect the views of Nebraska Extension or the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
We look forward to you joining us next week for another episode of Farm Beats.